The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Before the podcast begins, I would like to share with you some exciting news. Louis has released a knockout second title, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Round 2 from the amazing life and times of legendary South Florida attorney Louis Ress takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s via a spell in a top-secret Army department and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available now on Amazon. Just search Louis Ress. And before we start, don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, this is Jeanette with Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. And today we're on episode 24, Change of Venue. Louis, what is change of venue? Can you tell us a little bit about that before we jump in?
Right. Venue is the place where the trial is going to occur. So Right. It's the court, the location of the court. And it becomes a very significant part of a trial because if you try a case, for example, in Fort Lauderdale or Miami in Florida, there's an entirely different type of population than there is, let's say, in Naples or Bradenton. Mm-hmm. Those are areas in Florida that are extremely conservative. So in one instance, you're dealing with a liberal type of juror in general. And the other place, like Naples, you're dealing with an extremely conservative juror. So the place of the trial becomes very, very, very important.
Yes.
And this story involves an attempt to move the location of a trial. And it's a trial within a trial, because the trial has to do with the bona fides or the aspects of the case involving the claim, but the trial on venue is just where the trial should occur.
Oh, okay.
And that's a separate hearing with a separate judge and a separate trial with witnesses and everything else, just on that issue.
Wow. Okay. A trial within a trial. Here we go.
And this involves GEICO, which is Government Employees Insurance Company. And I'll tell you more about it and the moral of the story and the history of the story. It's a very fascinating story because the person involved in this trial was Leo Goodwin III. And Leo Goodwin III was the heir to the GEICO fortune.
Huh.
And I'll tell you all about it as we go along and who owns GEICO now and what happened to Leo. That'll all be coming at you.
All right.
In the meantime, this all came about as a result of a tremendous automobile collision, an accident. And, of course, it involved the heir of the GEICO fortune, Leo Goodwin III. There was a teenage high school football star in the car in front. He was killed in the crash. His girlfriend was severely injured. The red Porsche sports car that struck their Chevrolet Bel Air was going at about 85 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone. And it was being driven by the GEICO heir, Leo Goodwin III. Leo Goodwin III was then in his early 20s, and he was known to be a heavy drug user. Uh-oh. And he had caused at least 2 major accidents as a result of his irresponsible driving. One of them involved his Ferrari 308 GTB V8, which he crashed into a parked camper. In fact, he was so well known as a terrible driver that the circuit judge, Judge Fisher, his name was Gene Fisher, he was a wonderful guy. Gene Fisher considered him to be a public nuisance. And as such, he would prohibit him from driving in Broward County.
Yeah.
He said, you can't drive in Broward County.
This guy sounds terrible. I mean,
he was a bad young man.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, Gene Fisher ultimately prohibited him from driving any place in the state of Florida. over 1,000 citizens had signed a petition to stop Leo from driving. But the kid continued to drive. He continued to do drugs and to chase women and hang around in bars, one of which was a yacht club just on the south side of 17th Street Causeway in Fort Lauderdale, just opposite the Pier 66 Hotel. And I found out later that his father owned that yacht club that he was hanging out in. He was on probation, Leo. And when he was on probation, he left the country and toured Europe. Huh. He was not exactly
a responsible
fellow.
He was living the life. Yeah, he was living the life.
He was, he was a bad dude. The insurance company wouldn't tender the basic policy limits to the my client, who was the girlfriend, who was in that car that was slammed in the rear by the red Porsche that Leo was driving.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't, and they had an umbrella policy, which is an excess policy, and they weren't tendering anything. They had $1 million in basic coverage. And they were denying liability. They claimed that Leo's foot slid off a poorly designed clutch pedal. He was wearing thong slippers or something at the time. And they said that it wasn't his fault. The shoes were not right. The pedal wasn't designed. Anything but his responsibility. We filed suit. And the insurance company moved to have the case tried in Naples over in Collier County, where the jury verdicts were the lowest in Florida. Thus, there was a trial within a trial, like a play within a play. And we were in trial to see whether or not we could stay in Broward County or not,
wow,
in Fort Lauderdale. And the courtroom was packed, and we had the first hearing. Well, the lawyer for Leo Goodwin addressed the court, and he said, "Your Honor, we respectfully move the court to change the venue of this case to Naples, Florida, and in partial support, we show the court that Leo Goodwin III is not able to have a fair trial in Broward County due to the enormous publicity of a disparaging nature which has permeated this community. Why, every day and night, the newspapers, and particularly the Sun Sentinel, and the television channels, particularly CBS and NBC, have filled this community with a hatred for our client so severe that a fair and impartial trial is out of the question." That's pretty fancy language.
Yeah, I mean, the news was saying the truth, though. This guy was
You have to understand, I'm an old-timer, and we sort of remember these things. I didn't have a transcript. I'm just making that up as to what I recall he said. And I responded. It was my turn, and I said, "Your Honor, I represent the plaintiffs in this matter, and it's our position that there should be no problem in seating a fair and independently minded jury. Unless we seat juries and voir dire them and ask them about this case and what they know or don't know, how will we ever come to the conclusion that a proper jury cannot be found? The plaintiffs are entitled to have their case heard where the present jurisdiction lies, and the defense must prove by a preponderance of evidence that an objective jury cannot be found. Unless and until we actually place jurors in the box and question them, we'll never be able to say that a fair jury could not be found."
And what happened? What was the ruling on that?
Well, it wasn't so fast. There wasn't a ruling so fast. As I left the courthouse, at least five reporters and two television cameras teams came up to me and started asking me questions. And a group of Goodwin haters, who I believe were created and encouraged by the insurance company, surrounded me. Flash bulbs were going off. Bright TV lights were on me. And I was gently saying that we had no comment. I'm one of the few lawyers that doesn't make comments during a trial. I don't
see publicity.
But lawyers
are allowed to make comments, right?
Well, you have the right of freedom of speech. It's your constitutional right. But there are ethic problems. And every time you make a statement, you put your foot in your mouth, it can come back and bite you.
Yes.
The more you say, the more exposure you have for doing something silly. So I have a general rule.
No comment.
Keep my mouth shut during the trial. When it's over, sometimes I say something, but even then, it winds up in the appellate record. They put it in. Well, next day, there was a new amendment filed in the court pleadings, you know, and they filed a motion to change venue again. And they quoted the headlines from the Sun Sentinel and the TV reports that were transcribed, and they attached them to the pleading. So now all the evidence, new evidence, was what happened after the trial when I was interviewed with all these reports and articles. And they keep saying that now here's further evidence that a fair trial in Fort Lauderdale cannot be had. Well, we go back to the court for another hearing. This was hearing number 3. And it was just related to the adverse publicity, which kept coming and coming.
Mm-hmm.
This time I asked permission to address the court, and I turned to the spectators in the court. I turned around completely and faced the crowded spectators. And I said, all of you who are from the media, the newspapers, and the television stations, raise your hand. Almost every hand went up. The wow. judge was really ticked off. He was angry. He said, hold everything, Mr. S. What are you doing? You can't take over my courtroom. I said, judge, you're right. I just wanted you to see that this has become a media event in your courtroom in and of itself. And tomorrow you'll read about this hearing in the newspapers, and it will be on TV and on radio, and a new amended motion will be filed, and it will continue on and on and on until you rule.
And is that what happened? Did you forecast that?
Yeah, well, the judge looked at me and says, get on with it, gentlemen. Let's consider the polls that you wish to present. You know what polls are, you know?
No, tell me
polls,
about it.
When you go out and you interview people and you say X percent are going to vote for Biden
and Y percent
are going to vote for Trump or whatever, they take polls, election polls, they poll happiness polls.
Right.
What do you think of this product polls?
So
what
in this
is your
case,
position on the economy polls?
In this case, you had created a specific poll about
whether he could get a fair trial.
Gotcha.
If he was so hated and so disliked in the community that he couldn't get a fair trial. Well, they had polls. Well, I'll tell you about the polls later on because it's a fascinating business, the poll business. And the integrity of the polling companies. Anyhow, the GEICO people, the insurance company, put on two experts on the stand. Each was from a well-known professional polling company. And they had employees taking telephone polls of 50 persons during the 6 o'clock mealtime hour. 80% of them stated that they would like to see Leo Goodwin III hanging by his neck from the nearest lodge tree,
wow.
or words to that effect. My experience was in situations like that, they took many polls using different employees until they got the results that they wanted. Then the unfavorable polls and the people that took them sort of disappeared.
So what did you do about that?
Well, we were allowed to respond. So I called my cute, petite receptionist to the stand, Doris. Doris had taken a poll at my request, calling 50 people at random from the telephone book, all of those people living in different parts of Fort Lauderdale. She brought her records and her notes with her and testified that hardly any of the persons she polled even knew of Leo Goodwin III, and not one of them knew of the pending trial, and all of them said they had no opinion with regard to this case. They didn't know what was going on, and she was so pretty and charming and spoke in such a sweet and naive voice that the defense didn't even try to cross-examine her.
And did you take multiple polls?
Of course, we did the same thing they did.
Wonderful.
You know, you fight fire with fire.
Yeah.
Actually, we had discarded 5 prior polls taken by other secretaries in my office that expressed the general hatred of Leo Goodwin III. Well, the next day, of course, the same thing. TV and the radio started screaming, Goodwin defense polls show fair trial impossible.
So
back to court for hearing number 4.
And what happened next?
Well, we go to hearing number 4, and now they bring on their psychiatrist.
Okay.
And the psychiatrist is going to testify about whether you can get a fair trial in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
So the psychiatrist was an assistant professor, and his name had been listed as an expert, and I had plenty of time to check him out and get my own psychiatrist. Their witness, Professor Black, was a board-certified Florida State University medically trained psychiatrist. He was a professional witness who made the better part of his living as a trial expert. He advertised his availability. I checked his research background, and I looked for any articles that he may have written. You know, you prepare.
Yeah, you want to know what this guy's about.
Right.
Yeah.
Did he write something? Maybe he wrote something that I can cross-examine him with. Nothing. I couldn't find anything. And I said, well, maybe it's smarter to go the other way. Instead of looking for articles that he wrote, look for all the change of venue cases in Florida that I can find and see if he ever testified in any of them. Well, bingo. He testified for the famous plaintiff's attorney, Murray Sams, in Miami, Florida, on a change of venue case. And his testimony had never been transcribed.
Oh, okay.
And he testified for the plaintiff then. In a different, and now he's testifying for the defense. So it had to be interesting. Well, what would he be doing testifying for Murray Sams, who was trying to stop being transferred to Naples? They were trying to send him to Naples, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had to be testifying the exact opposite of what he was now trying to do, say. He was trying to help the other side.
Yep.
So I found the court reporter. His name was Jerry Schwartz. And he was able, he's a very nice guy, he was able to find the transcript of that trial.
Oh, perfect.
And he got it transcribed for me. He got it typed up.
That's great.
Now, and I listened, it was recorded too. Now I listened to this whore swear, this Dr. Black, swear that Goodwin could never get a fair trial, and quoting all of the phony statistics to support his conclusion. His testimony, now he was testifying that the insurance company couldn't get a fair trial in Broward County.
Huh.
And he had a written report. And his report, word for word, said the following. It said, in my considered opinion, within the realm of medical and psychiatric probability, based on the huge amount of adverse publicity and the polls and the lynch atmosphere in this community directed against him, that Mr. Goodwin can never get a fair or objective trial in this venue of Broward County, Florida. Okay? Mm. And now the insurance company's attorneys, Goodwin's attorneys, turned him over to me and said, you're a witness.
And what does that mean when they say you're a witness?
Your witness means we're done with presenting this witness, and now you have your chance to cross-examine.
I see.
So it's your witness to cross-examine. Mm. Boy, was he going to be my witness. Wow, was I after him. I started off gently. And here's the trick, and one of the whole points of this discussion, of how you handle an expert witness.
Hmm.
I started off very gently, going over the number of times he has testified as an expert. I asked him his fees. They don't like that.
Hmm.
Because it sounds like they're selling themselves, that they're prostitutes.
Which is the truth.
Which they are. His advertising. Where did he advertise? What did he pay for advertisements? How often did he send it out? Was it in newspapers, journals, whatever? Just enough to get him irritated the way he was looking to get me. He was literally looking to get me. Then I said, Dr. Black, allow me to ask your opinion of the following. And the following expert testimony. And I recited slowly. All the polls claiming prejudice in a change of venue case are meaningless. All of the testimony of experts talking about publicity requiring a change of venue is a sham. Scientifically, there is no way to say that a community is so tilted that a fair trial cannot be had. Unless and until a jury is impaneled, no one who is responsible can say that in any case should be removed to another jurisdiction. I stake my professional reputation on this. I said, Dr. Black, do you agree with that? What are your comments? Dr. Black took the bait and swallowed the hook.
Oh, boy.
He said, Mr. S., that's the biggest liar in the world. He looked at the jury and he said, that statement's just untrue. It is inaccurate, totally incorrect, misleading, unscientific, and had to come from a total imbecile. No, I certainly do not agree with it. I waited. I paused. I said, Dr. Black, do you remember testifying in the Arbita case for Murray Sams in Miami? You did testify in that case, didn't you? Silence. I have the official court reporter standing outside this courtroom. That was your expert testimony that I quoted. You said those things after being sworn and under oath.
Oh, my. You got him.
There was dead silence. Black couldn't get out of it. He said, how did you find that? Then he got up and walked out. He was gone.
Oh, yeah. That's it. He's done for.
So what happened?
Yeah, what happened after that?
The judge says, I heard enough. Motion to change venue is denied. There was a rush to the door. The flashbulb started to go off. The reporters pressed, and I finally said, I think we'll get a fair trial right here in Fort Lauderdale. Well, Tom Randall, Goodwin's lead attorney, came up to me and said, Lewis, we're tendering the first $1 million. That's our policy limit. Bill Harris is in his office and expecting you. He's the excess carrier, and they've got more.
So, I'm sorry, when you said tendering, what does that mean?
Offering.
Okay.
And they offered me their policy limits. Then I went to see Harris in his office, and he tendered the balance. And believe it or not, at that time, the Geico stock wasn't worth very much, and Leo was only standing in line to inherit it. He had nothing in his own name, and his father, the $60 million tycoon, was facing bankruptcy.
Oh, wow.
That's it. Leo Goodwin III didn't learn much. He never apologized or repented. And then I'll tell you what happened to him.
Yeah. Where did he end up? Did he change his ways? Did he learn from this at all? Or what was the outcome?
Well, there's a lot to be learned from the story. The outcome was that we collected the policy limits. The case was settled. I'll tell you about Leo Goodwin III and the Goodwin family, because it's interesting. What happened to him? Well, he wound up dying.
Ugh.
He died.
That's tragic.
Yeah, of a drug overdose.
Wow.
At age 25. He was, 25 years old, I think, when he died. Actually, the Goodwin family was very interesting. He was the only bad apple. Leo Goodwin Sr., at age 50, was a quiet and a humble and a sincere fellow. He traveled as an auditor for the railroad and an accountant for a Texas insurance company. Hmm. And he came up with this idea of an insurance company catering to government employees and enlisted military officers.
Hmm.
So you see, GEICO is Government Employees Insurance Company, GEICO. Nobody knows that.
No, I didn't know about that.
And he and his wife was very active. She was a very nice lady. Lillian was her name. And she died in 1970. He started the company in 1936, by the way.
Hmm.
Had a son, Leo Goodwin Jr. Well, Leo Goodwin Jr. was a former Texas Ranger and a colonel in the CIA. He was a very nice guy. He's a gentleman. And he was very benign. He was heir to this fortune. Well, he winds up that the GEICO stock went from 60 to 4, down to 4, and they went bankrupt. And Leo Goodwin Jr. filed bankruptcy in the 1970s.
Hmm.
Now, GEICO is owned by Berkshire Hathaway. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
They acquired it in, I think, 1996, if I recall.
Oh, wow.
And they have like 17 million auto policies covering 28 million vehicles. You've seen it.
Mm-hmm. The little gecko.
That gecko thing and running around. That's them. Mm-hmm. Well, Leo Goodwin III started out, I guess, at 17, getting into trouble driving.
Mm-hmm.
At 18, he got his girlfriend pregnant and had a daughter with her. She was born in 1970. I forget her name, but she is still living. She's now about 19 years old. And there's tremendous litigation between... Leo Goodwin Sr. left 3/4 of his estate to Leo Goodwin Jr. and 1/4 to Leo III.
Mm.
But what happened, Leo III wound up, well, he was convicted of, at age 17, he was convicted of selling LSD and marijuana. He put on 4 years probation. Age 18, he gets his girlfriend pregnant and they have a child. Age 21, Judge Butterworth, the county judge, Bob Butterworth, who was famous in Florida, gave him 37 days in jail and 2 years probation. Then he was shot in the leg. He had a second accident. He hit a Park Campo and a Lincoln Continental, and they both caught on fire.
Oh, my gosh.
Then he wound up with the Outlaws motorcycle gang in Charlotte, North Carolina, gets shot in the leg. And he died of an overdose in 1977 at age 25. His father survived him.
Yeah.
He lived until age 63. So he survived him by about a year, I guess, and he died.
Hmm.
So that it tells you, and Leo Goodwin Jr., by the way, these guys, he had a private intelligence agency. He was the yacht broker, and they endowed Nova Southeast University.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you go to Nova Southeast University College of Law, you have the Leo Goodwin Foundation. I gave him $16.5 million to Nova. I did some digging. And Leo Goodwin Jr., they did the residence hall on the main campus back in 1974. So these are very, very philanthropic people.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this kid who is a bum.
Yeah.
Well,
I wonder what happened there.
You learn a lot. There's so much to learn in this story.
Hmm.
First of all, it tells you that money can ruin you.
Yeah.
And you get a kid like that who's spoiled,
mm-hmm.
too much money, living above their means, spending crazy. Even when they're bankrupt and the stock goes from 60 to 4,
yeah.
the kid's still crazy out there. Drugs,
mm-hmm.
alcohol,
expensive cars,
women,
yep.
fast cars. This is a vacuous, meaneless, horrible life, and it's not happy. These people are not happy.
Yeah, it's a live fast, die young mentality, pretty much.
I did some tracking down of how many celebrities wind up dying from drugs and alcohol and psychiatric problems that have too much.
Hmm.
So you have to, the moral of the story is to balance your life and live well within your means. And my father had a rule that live so well within your means that when you have your ups and downs and your bumps in life, you don't have to change your lifestyle.
Hmm.
It doesn't affect you. Mm-hmm. You're cushion mm-hmm. yourself. And stop trying to buy happiness. You can't.
Yes.
It doesn't work.
I think that's huge.
Within yourself.
I think that's huge,
and,
yeah.
People don't stop and realize that. The guy that's mopping the floors in the office building could be as happy as the guy in the penthouse with his feet up on the desk who may be miserable.
Yeah, there might be a huge emptiness inside
of
that.
You don't have to worry
person.
About your friends being friends because of what you can do for them or the parties you throw.
Yeah.
They're friends because they care about you. That's a nice feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you something else about venue shopping. That's a dirty business.
Hmm.
But it's done for a lot of good reasons, too. For example, all your civil rights litigation, done mostly by places like the Southern Poverty Law Center out of Montgomery, Alabama, they shop for the venue. They go to courts, let's say in California or something, and they look for a case there where they can go before a court that's sympathetic and get a positive ruling and then have that. It's easier to sustain a ruling than it is to reverse it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they try to do. And then you learn about expert witnesses. Well, and judges. I talk about judges, too. Judges are under, there's a tilted playing field, you know. So if you want to tilt it for yourself, well, the Republicans have been trying to tilt the judicial mm-hmm. playing field in the United States for like 8 years now.
Yeah.
And Mitch McConnell is the villain, in my opinion. And they put on at least 60... right-wing federal judges that he's pushed through the Senate. He's brought the senators back from vacation just to put through more judges. And this is the same with Carl, what's his name, talk about the Republican guru. I'll think of his name. But that's the big thing is to get Republican judges in there. So the whole mm-hmm. judiciary, you three branches of government. Well, they control the Senate. They have the House.
Yeah.
And then they control the Supreme Court. And now they're going to control the federal judiciary.
Yeah, not good.
And judges like to be considered independent, very independent. They don't appreciate it. But when you get people who are members of this organization, like they go to the Federalist Society. Well, you know what that is at all?
I'm familiar with it. As far as the Federalist Papers and where that originated, but it's changed quite a lot since then.
It's not the Federalist Papers. This is a group of very, very right-wing, ultra-conservative judges. And this really comes out of Yale. And I was telling you that these people interpret the Constitution or believe in the interpretation of the Constitution as of the date it was written. And they complain about liberals who also tend to make it like a rubber band and expand it in order to accommodate liberal thinking, which is just as bad in many ways,
yes.
and stretch it to into stuff that it was never intended to cover.
Right.
So that they interpret the Constitution beyond what it really covered.
Hmm.
And, of course, what is not covered by the Constitution or delegated to the federal government, is left to the states under the Constitution. Well, they don't like that because the states are pretty corrupt. Mm-hmm. And the state legislatures are these small town people who work part-time and take cash on the side for the campaigns.
Yeah.
And they run a little business, and it's very, very, very bad. There was a time in Florida when every time I won a case, an appellate case, company, this large company, would cost them about $300,000 to $500,000 to bribe the legislature to change the law to exclude my case from the law.
What?
Yeah, and the result of my case was blotted out by a new law. So,
what?
Yeah, it would cost. Name the company, but I'd be sued.
No, of course. But how is that even possible? Like how
do they get $5,000 for a couple of boys up the line in Panhandle and so on?
Oh my gosh!
They have a little business. Maybe they own an insurance agency for State Farm or something, and they have a farm in the back of the house, and $5,000 to them is a lifetime of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they get $5,000 for their campaign, and they're told, here's the law, you present it to the legislature, and don't worry, it'll go through. And the law says, well, to amend such and such and such and such and provide for such and such, and my case was gone.
Wow.
So every year I'd win a case in the courts, and then the legislature would pass something to do away with the result of that case.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's life.
So there are no measures to sort of police that a little better?
There's nothing you can do.
Wow.
It still goes on. It's going on right now. We had a thing, for example, the convicted felons that they were released from prison or something,
mm-hmm.
they had the right to vote. They were given the right to vote.
Right.
So then the legislature passed a law saying, well, they can't vote unless they pay all their back fines and back taxes and all the money they owe based on judgments that were issued against them.
Uh-huh.
And they knocked out all these felons from past felons from voting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's corrupt.
Wow.
And of course they did it because they vote for one particular party rather than another.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, does that give you an idea?
Oh, yeah.
It's a fascinating, fascinating study of the law and the judiciary. And the judges in general are pretty fine people. And they consider themselves in a separate profession,
mm-hmm.
Not lawyers and not politicians, but in effect, they're politicians.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's very political. Yeah.
And when they're told to appear at a meeting, the director of the FBI is coming down to Washington, Miami, and they're having a cocktail party, the federal judges appear.
Uh-huh.
They appear.
They're there.
They're at the Biltmore. You can find them at the Biltmore. Carl Gables at the cocktail party.
Having some drinks.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Lewis. I learned quite a lot. I can't wait for our next episode. Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone.